can show me one example in the history of the world of a single psychic who's been able to prove under reasonable experimental conditions that they are able to read minds. And if anyone can show me one example in the history of the world of a single astrologer who's been able to prove under reasonable experimental conditions that they can predict future events by interpreting celestial signs. And if anyone can show me one example in the history of the world of a single homeopathic practitioner who's been able to prove under reasonable experimental conditions that solutions made up of infinitely tiny particles of good stuff dissolved repeatedly into relatively huge quantities of water have a consistently higher medicinal value than a similarly administered placebo. And if anyone can show me one example in the entire history of the world of a single spiritual or religious person who's been able to show either empirically or logically the existence of a higher power with any consciousness or interest in the human race, or ability to punish or reward humans for their moral choices, or that there is any reason other than fear to believe in any version of an afterlife, I will give you my piano. One of my legs and my wife.
That was Tim Minchin singing a song called If You Open Your Mind Too Much, Your Brain Might Fall Out. And you're listening to Radio Free Thinker, a radio show put on by the UBC Free Thinkers Club. That was a mistake by our technical guy, Daniel. Right, this is a radio show put on by the UBC Freethinkers Club on CITR 101.9 in Vancouver. I'm Elon, and we've got a great show for you today. We're going to have part two of our interview with James Randi. We're going to talk about the legality of drugs, part two of that discussion. But first, let me introduce you to my panel of distinguished freethinkers, starting with Don.
Hello.
Rob.
Howdy.
And Ethan.
Hey, everybody. And did you guys know that on March 31st, 1492, Queen Isabella of Aragon issued the Edict of Expulsion, forcing Spain's 150,000 Jewish people to either convert to Christianity or get out.
Wow, that sucks for them.
So why did she do that?
Because she was a Catholic and she didn't...
Ethan, watch out. Watch what you say. According to a new... UN, how do you like that segue, guys? According to a new UN proposal, which has been passed, they've made a law making it illegal to defame religion. It's called the Defamation of Religion Rule. And this resolution, which was introduced by Pakistan, basically says that it's not allowed to say something critical about religion. That should be something that, or will they say defamation of religion? The actual thing that the Pakistan group brought up is they said defamation of religion is a serious affront to human dignity, leading to a restriction on the freedom of their adherents and incitement to religious violence.
So if the UN actually passes this as a binding resolution, we could all be arrested by UN peacekeepers?
I guess like our show would definitely be a blasphemous show, and a lot of people are calling this the sort of anti-blasphemy resolution, which is kind of scary because, you know, it comes down to how valuable is our free speech?
Exactly. No, I think, you know, it's bizarre. Now, this is about the speech or is it about someone? I mean, because I can see it making sense. If I say, let's all kill the Pope, don't do it. But if I said that, I could see that being bad. But if I said, Jesus wasn't a great person and we shouldn't follow the Bible, I mean, are both of those covered or is the one? Because the first one makes sense. But
it seems very vague. Which is sort of, I think, a thing that makes it sort of, it seems like it's fostering tolerance, you know, saying, you know, it's bad to, insult people. And certainly it's not nice. But at the same time, you know, this could be something that fosters intolerance, especially since it's so vague. Maybe now a country could sort of be justified in being able to sort of have things like women's rights being not observed and things. And then they could justify it by...
Well, basically, if any country can justify repression of any sort by saying it's part of our religion, they're off limits. So no one can criticize them.
So out of curiosity, remember the Denmark cartoons?
Right.
So it would be illegal for them to publish those cartoons, but it would have been legal for the people to riot in the streets.
Well, I don't think they're saying that it's legal to get violent, except at the same time, you know, this, they might get very angry. it's a gray area, I guess. Like, it's just a very disturbing sort of resolution to be passed. There was
frightening, chilling, I'd say.
There were 200 secular and religious and media groups from around the world that urged the United Nations to reject this resolution. So there are even people that are adhering to religions are saying that this is not a good idea.
But anyways, they're going to have another vote on this as well, so it may not become a binding resolution.
Right. Well, anyhow, let's move on to station ID.
A long time ago, in a city far, far away,
CITR
was born. In the decade ahead, America will be in space.
CITR
is already there. Astronaut Neil Armstrong had this to say about
CITR.
It's one small step for man.
So vote.
CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Herbert R. Tarlick, Chairman.
On May 12, 2009, BC is faced with a provincial election. Students should vote. When we speak up, they will listen.
Vote for candidates who support a reduced tuition to increase access to better education, better transit, and adequate funding to universities.
On May 12, vote in the BC elections.
This is a message brought to you by the AMS External Office, authorized by the AMS, registered sponsor under the Elections Act, 604-822-2050.
Welcome back. So if you recall last week on Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 in Vancouver, we discussed the dangers of drugs, specifically marijuana. This week we're going to talk about how these dangers correlate to the law. And to give us an intro to this, we have Rob.
So the UN, the WHO, the DEA, and a number of other organizations like that claim to classify the legality of drugs based on their relative risks and dangers. And as skeptics, we're interested in finding out if this is true. Well, in 2007, a journal article was published in The Lancet, a prestigious British medical journal, in which a number of universities, medical research council, forensic science centers collaborated to categorize the harm of drugs and see how correlated those classification was with how illegal drugs were. And they categorized drugs on three factors: physical harm, how dangerous they are to your health, whether there's a risk of getting HIV from shared needles, that sort of thing, how dependent you get on the drug psychologically or physically, and social harm, which isn't often done. This is the new part of the study. How often does the drug increase violent behavior? How does your money get misspent? What's healthcare costs?
Driving under the influence.
Yeah, stuff like that. And so they got independent ratings of the dangers of the drugs in these three factors by experts in law enforcement, legal professions, medical centers, social workers, psychiatrists, even users. And they found that the correlation between the legality and the danger of drugs is completely insignificant. The worst uncontrolled substances are cigarettes, booze, and sleeping pills. More dangerous by far than cannabis, LSD, or E.
What were the most dangerous drugs?
Heroin was agreed by pretty much everyone to be the most dangerous drug, and it is classified as a dangerous drug in the UK and in the States. And the second most dangerous was cocaine.
So those two sounds like they probably got right, but after that, it's a quick drop-off.
Well, actually, I noticed, too, that there was a study done by Robert Johnson Foundation for the Southern Economic Journal that made a similar comment that casual drug use has no economic effect on your work. So, I mean, if you smoke up on the weekend or if you have a drink or two, it doesn't actually affect your job performance, or at least study shows, which is really important because other studies have shown that businesses will spend up to $20 to $30 million every year on drug testing, right? And that's drugs, not alcohol or tobacco or that, right? Which seems to be a far bigger drain on the economy than someone toking up on the weekend.
Well, so going back to your study, Rob, that you were talking about, how did the dangers of marijuana, which is a very popular drug that a lot of people are trying to legalize, how did that compare to things that are already legal, such as caffeine or alcohol or cigarettes?
So I'm just looking at a graph here, which I'll post up on the blog after the show so everyone can read this study. Cannabis was considered less dangerous than tobacco, alcohol, barbiturates, all of which are legal, by far. In fact, the study discusses using cannabis as the point of demarcation for whether drugs should be considered dangerous and illegal or not.
I think actually going on that, in Portugal in 2001, they actually decriminalized drugs. And this was cannabis.
All drugs?
All drugs. So to use drugs in Portugal is illegal. It's trafficking, selling is still considered illegal. But some very interesting things have shown up in that. I mean, there was an increased use of cannabis, which your study says really isn't a big deal. But remarkably, there was a decrease in the use of heroin, an increased uptake in treatment, so people actually going to try and get themselves healthy from addictions increased, and there was a rapid reduction in the amount of drug-related deaths. Between 1999 and 2003, the deaths related to drugs almost halved in that period, actually over halved. It went from about 370 to 150. There's been similar reductions in HIV. The number of people, again, trying to go into drug treatment almost doubled, right? And all this was just from, instead of looking at it as a criminal activity, as a public health issue, which a number of groups in that promote.
So simply changing the legal definition of someone who is addicted to drugs, these massive changes in policy and health changed?
Well, think of it. If I'm addicted to heroin right now, right? And depending on where I am in the world, if I try, I go to the cops or I go to someone saying I'm addicted, right? They're going to say, oh, so you use that? I go, yes, I'm a criminal. And I'm instantly treated as a criminal. So really the only other option I have in those companies is to go to my pusher to ask for help to get me off the drugs. And of course, pusher is not going to want you to do that, right? So you sit there. And there's such a hypocrisy in our society. If you sit there and you look at the presidents, the last three presidents of the United States, one smoked but didn't inhale. The last one had a coke conviction. And the current one apparently experimented with blow when he was a kid. And I mean, if they're criminals, then they shouldn't be allowed. But I mean, they were elected the highest office in the United States. So there seems to be a lack of coordination.
Actually, the question of legalizing marijuana in the States came up recently. Obama was holding an internet roundtable discussion or something like that. And a number of groups that are promoting the decriminalization of marijuana completely, one could say, hijacked these discussion forums. They posted hundreds and thousands of questions in every way they could. And in the televised discussion period, Obama basically flippantly ignored the question. He mentioned that it just wouldn't be a good way of growing the economy and moved on.
He turned it into a joke.
Yeah.
Which, of course, leads to the big thing about the war on drugs. I mean, the war on drugs was technically started by Nixon in the 70s. And according to The Economist, the actual usage of drugs hasn't changed. It's about 5% of the world's population use drugs, and it hasn't changed even with this thing. Yet the United States spends $40 billion a year on drug enforcement. But it has no effect. It arrests 1.5 million people on drug offenses, but it doesn't change it. It's been determined that the biggest thing that causes the increase in prices that makes it the most expensive to society isn't the production of drugs, but the distribution. Right, and in that, there's been absolutely almost little effort.
Right. I guess the distribution costs are so high because of this war on drugs, making it so difficult for the producers of the drugs to move it around.
Exactly. When they sat there, they said that if you destroyed the crops, if you used weed killer like they do in Colombia to get rid of the crops, that does have an effect on the street price, right? It increases by about four times, right? But in the attempts to reduce the drug war, they actually increase it by 100-fold, which you think is good. But then you think about it. What is the main driver in a capitalist society but profit? And if you make something 100 times more profitable, then you drive people to do it. That's why it's been estimated that the illegal drug industry is worth $320 billion a year.
Yeah, interesting. I found a statistic. In the entirety of the UK, the costs due to the trafficking and health costs of drugs, this is all the health costs, social worker costs, and the costs of dealing with drug-related crime, comes to 10 to 16 billion pounds per year, which is a lot for something that needn't be that large if you decriminalized a few drugs.
Yeah, I guess that's the funny thing in the end. Like, all this money spent on this war on drugs, which, first of all, isn't even working, and second of all, as we've said already, it would actually probably be beneficial to society if these were legal in the first place.
Well, a study done by the RAND Corporation showed that for every dollar spent on substance abuse treatment, resulted in a $7 saving in social costs. And, you know, crime, prisons, that sort of thing. And further, that... there's a 15, how do I put this? For every dollar spent on law enforcement, you would get 15 times more benefit if you put it on drug treatment. And this is by the RAND Corporation, which is far from some lefty socialist, let's all get hippie kind of group, right? Mm-hmm.
Not that we have anything against hippies.
Love it.
So I guess, faithful listener, you probably could get what side we're on this issue, but we'd love to hear what you think. If you email us at freethinker.ubc@gmail.com.
Radio.freethinker@gmail.com.
Radio.freethinker. Yes, I completely said the wrong email address. I apologize. So why don't you go and send an email now while you're listening to this commercial?
If they're in their car.
And if you're in your car, then drive safely.
Welcome to the show. You're listening to 101.9 FM. This is CITR, the Morning After Show. My name is Osvaldo Perez.
Van Music and CITR presents the 10th anniversary of the Morning After Show. On April 10th at the Legion on Commercial Drive, 2205 Commercial Drive. Doors open at 2 p.m. There'll be 11 bands. $10 advance tickets can be bought at High Life Records on Commercial Drive or through vanmusic.ca. You can also phone 778-862-1577. Playing at the show is Los Furios, Hawaiian Bibles, Los Malos, The Get Down, Michelle Carter-Lees, Sinister Black, The Rain in the Sidewalk, Tom Girl, Jess Hill, Mac Hunter, and the Aching Heart Foundation. It's April 10th at the Legion on Commercial Drive. Be part of the movement.
Morning After Show, every Tuesday at 11:30 a.m. You can listen at www.citr.ca or at 101.9 FM. The Morning After Show, 10 years playing your future favorite song.
Welcome back to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 in Vancouver. Last week we played part one of our amazing interview with the amazing James Randi, and here's part two. Enjoy.
So, Mr. Randi, this is Ethan here. I was just going to ask you, regarding the claims of psychics, have you ever had a psychic admit to you, perhaps privately, that they are in fact a con artist and that you're making their life very difficult?
No. It would be refreshing to find this, but I have had a couple of people over the years who have tried to do an imitation of our famous Alpha Project, where we sent two young fellows who are just amateurs in mentalism, that is, mental magic, so to speak. They were amateurs at it, but they had a pretty good knowledge of how it was done, and we sent them into a parapsychological lab. I guess that was 1987 or so. In order to fool the PhDs that were there, the scientists, because the scientists decided to trust them. Scientists, they trust photons and crystals of copper sulfate and various things like that, because these things don't turn on them and deceive them. But the kids were sent in there in order to show that these scientists could be fooled, and the scientists were thoroughly fooled, accepted them, and were prepared to turn out a scientific paper on the subject. But we had agreed in advance, the kids and myself, that we would reveal the hoax before they issued a scientific paper. And we did that in order to save them embarrassment.
Do you think these scientists changed their minds about the existence of
paranormal
activities?
These particular ones? No, they did not. They decided after we revealed it as a hoax and showed what the working methods were, they decided to search through the data that they had until they found ones that didn't match that exact description. They said, ah, but here we have the proof, because they really were psychic, though they're denying that they're psychic and such, but though they deny it, we know they were psychic because we're scientists. And this is a defense mechanism they have set up. What they're doing is saying that they're afraid to say that they were wrong.
So do you think some people, like these scientists, do you think they truly believe, or they just were afraid to say they were wrong, and that's it? They don't actually believe the claims, or
no, they believe the claims. They thoroughly believe the claims. They behave themselves as if they did, and they certainly acted towards the kids as if they did. And, of course, the kids have been given an instruction in advance that if they ever say to you, was that a trick, you must immediately say yes, and we were sent here by James Randi. But they were never asked that question.
So for such true believers, do you even think it's possible to change their mind at all?
I suppose so. Somewhere along the line, I've had a couple of scientists abandon the direction they were going in parapsychology and such and turn to much more useful things. As a matter of fact, the scientists in charge of the Alpha Project that I was just telling you about, they went back to doing physics and genuine science, and they dropped the original charm that they had for parapsychology, and they got into more serious things. They've been turning out scientific papers ever since.
All right. Thank you. So in the you have founded this James Randi Educational Foundation. Could you tell us a little more about what the JREF does?
Well, we're an educational foundation, as our title implies, and what we do is we serve as a as an information source for the media, for students, for scientists, for writers and such, people who, and just for the plain curious, who want to come by, want to tap in on our webpage and look around. It's all available to people. We're a nonprofit organization, and therefore we provide all these services free. They are welcome to come by and share our library, and under certain circumstances, they can actually borrow from the library. We have over 2,000 books here, moving up on 3,000 rapidly, and these are all available to these folks. So that's our main function. We try to keep the media and anyone who really wants to know informed about these things. We get very few calls from the media because, frankly, they don't want to know. If they've got a good story, it sounds good, and their editor says that it's good, then they've fulfilled their function. It doesn't have to be true. It doesn't have to make any sense. It doesn't have to be rational or real, any of those things, as long as it gets the sponsors happy because their product is being purchased.
So I recall hearing at your talk that you received some claims at the JREF for to claim a $1 million prize. Could you tell us a little more about that $1 million prize?
Well, we established a $1 million prize just over 10 years ago. The money, that one lump sum, was given to us by an obviously wealthy gentleman in Maryland, and in the state of Maryland, and he... He gave us that money so that we would have some teeth in our offer. Up until then, it was only $10,000 or so, which is not very much money nowadays, especially in American currency, as you may have noticed. But the $1 million is still $1 million, and it is a big enough carrot that they should come after it. That prize is available to any person or persons who can provide evidence of any paranormal, occult, or supernatural power or force or demonstration or ability of any kind under proper observing conditions.
Didn't, what's that psychic's name? The female psychic?
Sylvia Brown.
Sylvia Brown. Didn't Sylvia Brown once accept the $1 million challenge?
Well, wait a minute. You said that Sylvia Brown is a psychic?
Well, self-proclaimed.
Oh, a claimed psychic. Oh, that is a vast difference between the two, you see. Yes, we call her the Nails, by the way. Our nickname for her. Or Harpy, sometimes we commonly refer to her. Sylvia Brown agreed on the Larry King Live Show, which you probably know is broadcast internationally and is seen in thousands of outlets all around the world. In every civilized country of the world, most major hotels in all countries around the world actually have a connection to CNN and therefore to the Larry King Show. So she made a statement there that she would accept the challenge, and we let months go by, and we hadn't heard from her, so we asked through an intermediary, where is Sylvia? And she said she didn't know how to contact us. but
like
there are, on Google alone, there are 1.6 million references to the James Randi Educational Foundation. We're in the phone book. Our address is easily available, and we are reachable. And she talks to dead people, and she couldn't reach us because we're alive, as you may have noticed. But Sylvia then changed her tack and said, oh, I won't take the $1 million because he's not a godly person. Duh. It seems to me that that would be all the more reason for Sylvia to take the money from this evil person here. It is available. It's with Goldman Sachs, and we can give you the details on it, the account number and the whole thing with Goldman Sachs. If anyone would like to know, all they have to do is telephone us, email us, send us mail, or send us a message on tarot cards. I don't care how you do it, because we will answer that question. And we have never, never had an inquiry as to giving people proof that the prize exists. So thousands of people all over the world said, no, there is no $1 million. No, there is no million. He doesn't have $1 million at the foundation. It just doesn't exist. But we have right on our page the address and the phone number and all these things, our fax number, everything, every way of contacting us. And we say very plainly there, get a hold of us and we will forward you a copy of the document that says that there is $1 million. It's currently $1.14 million with Goldman Sachs Investment House here in the United States. It's available to you, that statement. We will send it to you by fax or by mail, any way you want. But no one has ever asked to see that evidence, though they know it is available. Surprising, isn't it?
It is.
And these are the same people who say the money doesn't exist.
It's much easier to say it if they don't have to actually prove what they're saying.
Yeah, well, that's the way they work.
So I have a question from one of our listeners, Susanna. She wanted me to ask, I guess along in the same camp as Sylvia Brown, there's a Deepak Chopra, perhaps, and he's actually coming to Vancouver very soon. And she was saying how a lot of her friends were really excited to go and see his talk, which he's charging around $100 for to get in. And it's a price that many people are willing to pay. What do you think about Deepak Chopra and his claims?
Deepak Chopra is the richest quack that I know of. He is a quack. He believes in humors and in medieval medicine from many, many centuries back. He believes in that sort of thing. He is a quack. There's no two ways about it. But he's a professional quack, and he's a very rich quack. And I have a bet going with journalists. If we're anywhere near a bookstore, I ask them to go into the bookstore with me, go over to the stack of Deepak Chopra books that's sitting there, take anyone at random, open up at any page, and on the double page that they open up to, I can point out an absolutely scientific howler, something really unscientific and against all knowledge that we have of actuality and reality, right there on at least one of them, on any two pages they turn to. And I've never lost that bet, because he is absolutely unknowledgeable about science. He uses terms like quantum physics and vibrations and wavelengths and such. He doesn't know what he's talking about, but he uses them to spice up his talk so he sounds as if he's being scientific.
Do you think that people are more willing to accept him because he uses kind of an anti-science mentality?
Oh, yeah.
He has way about him that he's going back to old medicine, that it's all natural.
Yeah. Well, of course, as I've often said, bird shit and gravel are natural, and I don't eat them. I don't know of anybody who does. But nonetheless, that's the kind of thing that they use, this word natural and vibrations, and they're all over the place. And Deepak Chopra he can't speak for more than 20 seconds without using the word vibrations, I'm sure. You could give him a basket full of vibrations, he wouldn't know what they look like.
So, elsewhere in the media...
James Randi. A friend of mine, Emily, just sent me a message saying, James Randi should really learn to form an opinion. He's so wishy-washy. Anyways, that takes us about to the end of our show. By the way, next week, our final conclusion to the James Randi interview. Lots of big twists coming up. But, yep, that's the end of this show. Please go to our blog. You could check out the show notes for the show at ubcfreethinkers.blogspot.com. You could also send us questions and comments to our email address, which is radio.freethinker@gmail.com. If you send us a good email, we'll read it on the air. But to close out the show, let's go to Don, who's going to give us a quote.
This week's quote is inspired by the UN's recent resolution on defamation of religion. We figured we should get this out of the way this week because next week it might be illegal. It's by Steve Weinberg in A Designer's Universe. He says, Frederick Douglass told in his narrative how his condition as a slave became worse when his master underwent a religious conversion that allowed him to justify slavery as a punishment of the children of Ham. Mark Twain described his mother as a genuinely good person, whose soft heart pitied even Satan, but who had no doubt about the legitimacy of slavery, because in her years in living in antebellum Missouri, she had never heard any sermon opposing slavery, but only countless sermons preaching that slavery was a God's will. With or without religion, good people can behave well, and bad people can do evil. But for good people to do evil, that takes religion. And that takes us to the end of our show. Thank you very much for listening. This is Don saying goodbye.
Thanks, Don. And go ahead, guys.
Well, I'll just say, no matter when you're listening to this show, if you downloaded it on our podcast, and please download our podcast. This is Ethan, and goodbye.
This is Rob. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Next week. Bye.